From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jerry Stahl co-wrote episodes of Moonlighting, Alf, and 30-something while he was a junkie. On today's archive edition, we'll talk about his memoir Permanent Midnight, which describes his predicament writing bad punchlines while shooting up in studio bathrooms. The new movie adaptation of Permanent Midnight opens today. It stars Ben Stiller. Also, we celebrate the 75th anniversary of Hank Williams' birth. We'll hear from Colin Escott, who wrote a book about the country singer's life and music, and we'll hear selections from a new Williams box set. And film critic John Powers reviews One True Thing, based on the Anna Quinlan novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Congressional Republicans say President Clinton should pay for the cost of the independent counsel investigation of the Monica Lewinsky matter. Kenneth Starr's office says the cost of the case was about $4.4 million. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Alaska Republican Senator Frank Murkowski asked Starr's office for an accounting of the 7-month investigation of the president's relationship with a former White House intern. He received a letter detailing nearly $4.4 million spent on personnel, travel, and consultant fees. Murkowski says those taxpayer dollars would not have been spent had the president not employed what he called a calculated strategy to delay and thwart the investigation.
Equity demands that the cost of the delays should be borne by the president and not the taxpayers of this country.
Such a move would not be unprecedented. The House required Speaker Newt Gingrich to pay $300,000 to defray the cost of his ethics investigation. Some lawmakers suggest a monetary sanction could be part of a punishment that falls short of impeachment. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Voters are going to the polls in 9 states and the District of Columbia today for primary elections. Turnout appears to be light in North Carolina, Maryland, and Massachusetts. In New York, former vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro is hoping to capture the Democratic nomination for the Senate. She is running against 2 other candidates, including Congressman Charles Schumer. In Washington, D.C., Mayor Marion Barry has declined to run for re-election. 7 Democratic candidates are trying to succeed him. Barry has not announced which candidate he's backing. Afghanistan's Taliban rulers have called for negotiation with Iran under United Nations laws. The Islamist militia hopes to defuse tension after Iran warned actions taken by the Taliban in Pakistan could spark a major regional conflict. Dale Gavlak reports.
Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar said the militia wants talks with Iran under UN auspices. Omar said he's ready to accept mediation, but didn't elaborate. Tension between the Muslim neighbors has escalated after the Taliban admitted killing 8 Iranian diplomats and a journalist in August. Recently, the last opposition town of Bamiyan, a Shiite stronghold, fell into Taliban hands. Iran's top religious leader warned war would erupt if the Taliban didn't stop military actions. Omar said the UN would blame Iran if it failed to accept his offer. The Taliban accused Tehran of interference in Afghanistan. Tehran, for its part, has accused the militia of defaming Islam and has supported opponents of the Taliban. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 14 points to 7,959. Trading is active. 297 million shares have changed hands. The Nasdaq is down 5.25 at 1660. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the third day may not be a charm, at least for the financial markets. Stocks open lower today. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
After 2 big up days, profit-taking and concerns about earnings are dragging some stocks down. Combined, the Dow Industrials gained 330 points last Friday and yesterday, and today's selling is in part an effort to lock in some of those gains. The markets are also trying to determine whether an interest rate cut from the Federal Reserve may be in the cards when that body meets later this month. In economic news, the government reports retail sales rose 0.2% in August. That was slightly weaker than expected. And the European Commission today granted pharmaceutical maker Pfizer final approval to market its anti-impotence drug Viagra in Europe. Individual EU governors will determine how quickly the drug will be made available and whether to allow their national health care plans to pay for it. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The new head of Russia's central bank wants to print more money to pay back wages. The new chief says once his board of directors is in place, he would like to increase the number of rubles in circulation. But economists are offering dire warnings. The number of new bills in circulation could lead to skyrocketing inflation. That happened in Russia at the beginning of this decade. It's also not known if Russia has enough assets to back up all the new cash that would be printed. Nations Bank says its proposed merger with Bank America is going forward despite a disappointing estimate of third-quarter earnings. Bank America reports its quarterly earnings will be affected by the global financial crisis, but it still expects to earn more than $500 million in the third quarter. Earnings during the same time period a year ago, $819 million. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Permanent Midnight, starring Ben Stiller, is based on the funny and horrifying memoir of the same name by Jerry Stahl. It's about the days when Stahl was a TV writer, husband, father, and junkie. While he was writing Family Fun for ALF, sexual innuendos for Moonlighting, and yuppie predicaments for 30-something, he was spending a lot of time in bathrooms, shooting up. Jerry Stahl had been getting high since high school. He started with pills and marijuana, then moved on to heroin when he was in his early 20s. After he finally got off drugs, instead of going back to television, he wrote his memoir. On this archive edition, we'll hear an interview I recorded with Stahl after the memoir was published in 1995. We started with a reading from the opening of Permanent Midnight.
The temptation is to be clever, to make it all wildly amusing. I published a story once, at 30 days off the spike, about doing dope in the studio where they shot ALF, banging so much stuff in the soundstage toilet, I heard the furry little puppet hissing my name and scratching at the door. I imagined, in my narco-dementia, that this 3-foot furry TV star, no more than a puppet with attitude, could see right through the bathroom walls. ALF was out there eyeballing all the blood I'd splattered on the mirror, on my fingers, into tiny scarlet puddles at my feet. But it was a family show, and he did not approve. See, it wasn't just the dope. It never is. It was the wrongness of the situation. I wasn't Chet Baker fixing behind the bandstand and blowing his heart out. I wasn't Johnny San Quentin shooting up in his jail tattoos and boosting stereos. I was Jerry Stahl, writing bad TV and hating it, desperately trying to counter his shame at the loathsome squareness of what he did with the secret hipness of what he thought he really was. The thing is, all my heroes were junkies. Lenny Bruce, Keith Richards, William Burroughs, Miles Davis, Hubert Selby Jr., these guys were cool. They were committed. They would not have been caught dead doing an ALF episode.
Jerry Stahl, did it always feel absurd and incongruous to be a junkie writing sitcoms?
That's the best thing it felt, was absurd and incongruous. It was basically mortifying on a 24-hour basis.
What did you feel you should really be doing?
Well, I was a very pretentious young guy, and I kept thinking, you know, would Dostoevsky be cranking out this Moonlighting right now, you know? And the reality is he probably would, because he was a gambler and he needed the dough. But that was the level I was operating on. And you have to understand about TV, when you consider yourself a writer and an artist with a capital A or a little A, you think of yourself as having a voice and being original. But the thing about TV, it's not about creativity, it's the opposite. It's about sounding like the guy who wrote the pilot, so that when you write those lovable characters, they sound just like they did last week. So you're basically a high-paid parrot in a very corporate environment, and I was not really a 9-to-5 kind of guy.
You're very funny in the book. You write that perhaps underneath the Bill Burroughs facade was a Dick Van Patten dying to get out. Did you ever think that heroin was going to, like, make you hipper?
Well, the lamer I got, the more desperately I think I clung to that particular illusion, because the really most grotesque revelation and the most hideous admission for me is that I was kind of good at it, you know? It was like I was kind of half William Burroughs, half Maury Amsterdam, you know? kind of a Maury Burroughs thing going on. So that, you know, I was like this sort of borscht belt junkie guy, you know what I mean? Because I could write gags. I still can. And a part of me always loved that stuff. It's just that, you know, Rose Marie wasn't hanging out. You know what I mean? The reality was it was slightly less glamorous and intriguing than working for Aetna Life and Casualty.
Did the people at ALF or Moonlighting or any of the TV shows you worked for realize that you were a junkie?
At the time, I'd like to think they didn't. I certainly know that they probably figured, man, he sweats a lot, sure seems to get the flu and spend an awful lot of those bathroom breaks just not coming back for a really long time. But they probably just thought I had some kind of weird, you know, malarial parasite of some kind. You know, down the road, now I've run into some of these people, they said, no, we didn't think you were a junkie. We just thought you were kind of weird and damp.
Weird and damp?
Well, you know, you always sweat a lot when you run out of stuff. And then when you shoot this stuff, you get a little kind of moist. And, of course, I always had to wear long sleeves, even on scorching, you know, 190-degree L.A. days, which is kind of a dead giveaway. But as I said before, it is such a square environment that I don't think it occurred to them that while they were bringing in their cappuccino and croissant, I was bringing in my rigs and Dilaudids.
Was it easier for you to write for programs that you had contempt for than it would have been to write something that you took really seriously?
Absolutely true. That is the story of my life. If I didn't care about it and thought it was dreck, I was really great at it, which is probably why I drifted more and more towards these kind of jobs for which I had contempt, which, if we can get real kind of dime store Freudian, was probably just because I had a lot of contempt for myself, you know, which is why I was doing those jobs. But you can sort of allay that self-loathing with the fact that they're just throwing money at you by the fistful. I mean, I had hundreds just spilling out of my pockets when I was in television.
Did you have to fake it a lot while you were working for television and getting high all the time?
Well, the beautiful thing about heroin is, you know, beautiful thing, listen to me. The thing that made it work and was actually most hideous about it is it induced a kind of faux conviviality. So that the only way I could muster the enthusiasm while taking the meetings to seem like, yeah, that's a great idea, Alf goes to a psychiatrist, was to get high and just find the right chemical balance so that I went in and these guys were just, God, he's just such a warm, understanding fellow, you know? And I would take these great meetings so that when I was face to face, I gave the appearance for 15 minutes of sort of being on the beam and concentrated and sharing their enthusiasm until, of course, I was back in my hovel, you know, staring at this electric, wondering what the hell I had gotten myself into and where were the drugs.
So you were pretty good at faking things.
I was terribly good. At one time, I had lined up a pilot, a movie deal, a memoir for somebody else, I think Frank Zappa's memoir of all things, to be ghostwritten, and I was still on Moonlighting. And subsequently, these people would call and say, where is the script? And I would be, well, what script? And then my agent would just have another minor aneurysm and get me out of it.
There was a period when you were making about $5,000 a week, but you say you were shooting about six. How much do you shoot a day for $6,000 worth of heroin?
Well, by that time, it wasn't just heroin. I was shooting coke as well. So I was shooting a few grams of heroin, which is about 100 a pop.
How many syringes worth is that?
I was just kind of around the clock, maybe a couple times an hour, especially when you start shooting speedballs, the late John Belushi's favorite drug.
That's cocaine and heroin.
That's cocaine and heroin. When you start shooting coke, it's not like heroin where you can only shoot it and then do it a couple hours later. You just become a human pincushion. You literally cannot stop fixing. So at that point, I was just a complete drug glutton.
How did you get out of television completely?
I fell out. You have to understand, it is very hard to fail in Hollywood at that level because the only reason people are giving you money is because the last people gave you money. It has nothing to do with talent. So I just blew gig after gig and basically disappeared off the map.
My guest is Jerry Stahl, author of the memoir Permanent Midnight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with Jerry Stahl. His memoir, Permanent Midnight, has been adapted into a new film starring Ben Stiller.
Here's what I'd like to know. I mean, you're a very educated guy. So you knew about how addicting heroin is, and you'd already had a lot of idols in music and literature who died as a result of their habits. So when you shot heroin the first time, did you think that you'd take your chances? I mean, knowing how dangerous it was?
Well, I wasn't viewing it as a career move at the time. I had been high pretty much every day for maybe 15 or 16 on one thing or another, so it was no big deal to try another drug. And long-term planning was not really my forte, so I guess I didn't look at the larger picture. At that moment, it was the right thing to do, and I dug it.
Did you have friends who were doing it?
Oh, yeah, I did. In the beginning, and in L.A., I hung out with some people who were doing it for a while. But, you know, by the end, it was just me. And when I was in TV, it was just me.
I know that your father committed suicide and your mother tried and failed but landed in a coma for a while. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that your family was, like, predisposed to, terrible depression. Do you think that that somehow contributed to your use of drugs?
Well, I definitely had the misery gene, that's for sure, that made drugs for me very appealing because on some level they kept me alive for a long time. I don't think I could have gotten through my teens and my 20s, which both of which are essentially like a black hole, without being high all the time. And
why not?
Because it was the only way I could not face what I had been through growing up and how depressed I was and all the weirdness and terror and deep-rooted torment I couldn't even handle. So I'm not advocating it, and it would have been much better probably to go to terrific shrinks and have it all ironed out. But for me, in that situation, pot and hallucinogens and speed and downs and what have you, it sort of just kept me afloat. In some ways, I feel very fortunate that I was able to just hit the bottom and collapse like I did, because now that I'm clean, I don't have to worry about working through all those problems. It's just gravy that I'm even walking around.
A lot of people who have given up alcohol or drugs say that you have to hit bottom before you can really give it up. Seems to me you hit bottom several times and kept going back for more. I mean, like, one of the times you hit bottom and it wasn't over yet was when your baby was born. Do you want to tell what happened?
I tell it only because it shows where you can go, and it illustrates the fact that when you are a junkie, no matter what's going on, what you are is a junkie taking care of your habits. So to make a long story short, I was in the OBGYN men's room while my daughter was being delivered, and I had ducked in there to get off, and right in the middle of it, the nurse came in and said, "Hey, it's happening, put on these scrubs." And of course, as I said before, I didn't wear short-sleeve shirts, and scrubs are a sterile short-sleeve garb that you wear in a delivery room. And I put those on rather hastily and ducked into the room where my child was being delivered at that very moment. And of course, I hadn't cleaned myself up. I was still bleeding slightly from the crook of my arm. And I looked at the doctor, and I just saw this level of contempt in his eyes, for which there's really no adjective. And he just looked at me as if to say, with a father like you, that child might as well go back where she came from, because what chance does she have? And to make matters worse, soon enough, the baby was born, and the nurse is handing me the scissors and saying, "Cut the umbilical." And at that moment, it's as if I had never done heroin before, and the rush was like one I had never experienced. I was weak in the knees and seeing double. And I kind of lurched forward to cut the umbilical cord, and by the grace of God, I avoided giving my child a third eye or my wife an impromptu hysterectomy and managed to cut the cord. But that was the mother of all bottoms. But as you say, it didn't stop me.
How come you think it didn't stop you? I mean, I'm just trying to understand more about what addiction's like, because people say, you know, you bottom out and that helps you, but it's hard to imagine much more of a bottom than that.
It's very simple. It is such a horrifying thing to have done that the mere memory of it, the mere realization that it happened, was so horrifying to me that I had become such an animal that I had to get high to obliterate the recollection of what I had done.
So was there another bottoming out that led you to actually want to kick as opposed to using more drugs to obliterate the memory?
I was always trying. I was in hospitals, rehabs, halfway houses. I kicked, as they say, on the street, cold turkey a number of times. But what it took for me was during the L.A. uprising when I was living in a garage and had no car and no bathroom and was just kind of on a concrete floor. And one day the Rodney King thing went down and I was stumbling south to get a Perrier to 7-Eleven or some water or something. And I noticed that the 7-Eleven looked different. And, of course, what it was a Buick sticking out of the plate glass window. And I stumbled in and got my water and subsequently got rounded up by the cops and had the horrific revelation I was being arrested for looting a Perrier, which is about the whitest thing a man can do. And this being L.A., this cops, you know, kept all the people of color and said, you get the hell out of here. And I went back to the garage and I tried to go catch a bus to cop and the buses weren't running. And I tried to call my connection and the phones were dead. So over the course of those days, the city was burning and so was I. And I finally stumbled out, I guess, two and a half days later, completely naked in this patch of grass, staring at the sky as it was kind of raining black feathers or something, as if I had died and awoken in a Garcia Marquez story. And what that was, of course, was ash. It was, the sky was black from all the burning buildings. And I just came to, like that moment in The Wizard of Oz when the house stops spinning and Dorothy steps out and the movie goes from black and white to color. I just, I made it to the other side.
So did you kick alone in the garage?
Yeah. Completely alone, cut off, and just occasionally staring at this image when the power was on of people looting buildings and seeing my face reflected on a TV screen so that it was as if people were looting appliances out of my forehead. And I just remember thinking, you know, go ahead, take it. You know, whatever is in my head, I don't need anymore.
So what is your life like now? It's been how many years that you've been clean?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. I'm really a very boring guy. You know, I'm just, I don't drink. I only have coffee on, like, national holidays because at this point my liver lives out of state. I washed ashore. You're laughing. I'm dying. I have hepatitis C.
That is Murray Amsterdam.
I have the cello right here, and I'll be happy to play a tune, and Pickles is waiting in the wings. You know, I live a very dull life on one level, but for a dope fiend who's been where I've been, you know, if you're a junkie, life is very black and white. You know everything that's going to happen. You either have the dope or you don't. It's real simple. You're going to be sick. You're going to be well. Now that I'm clean, every day is nothing but gray area. It's really the last frontier. I think it's the sheer novelty and weirdness of life on the Natch that keeps me plugging away. So, you know, I write in the mornings, whatever. Take care of my daughter in the afternoons, pick her up at school.
When you were writing back in the days when you were getting high all the time, you were, mm-hmm. you know, writing for television, you were writing for things you had contempt for. Then you not only had to deal with living without drugs, but you started to write a memoir, something that you couldn't have contempt for. I mean, you had to write something that you were able to stand by. You can't blame it on the guy who wrote the pilot or on the producer, or on the taste of the American public. It's your writing. Did that make everything even harder? Or was that a good opportunity to really throw yourself into something that you cared about?
Both of those things. It was terrifying on one level because, as you say, there's no place to hide. And for me, having written high all my life, what you realize was words for me were a means of sort of obfuscating the truth. You know, you could use words to dance around anything real. And I was very much about style and less about substance. I was a flashy, kind of gonzoed out writer and never wrote about myself. Probably never wrote an honest word, for that matter. And suddenly I get clean, and I had given up writing because I was so convinced I couldn't do it anymore. Then I published an article in a magazine out here called LA Style, and from that got the book deal. And then it just became this weird sort of, once I started, it was as if I had been waiting my whole life to spill these beans, you know? It was just one long exhalation. To say it was a catharsis is almost an understatement. It was just like a sustained explosion. I wrote 1,200 pages in about 9 months, which is mortifying in itself. But, you know, having done that and gotten through the other side and edited it down to 400, leaving a lot of the gnarly stories on the floor, I just really feel like that is over, thank God. And, you know, whatever's left is left, but I guess I can relax a little bit.
Back in your drug days, you used to wear black all the time, long sleeves, black leather coat. Do you still dress the same way?
I'm all about festive pastels now, Terry. I just think it's all about mauve and, you know, it's just how I am. Right now, if you could see me, it's just a cornucopia of pastel. Everything's changed about me.
So tell me, do you ever...
White shoes. I'm going to full Cleveland. White shoes, white belt, full leisure. I look great.
Jerry Stahl, recorded in 1995, his memoir Permanent Midnight has been adapted into a new film starring Ben Stiller. Stahl plays the role of a doctor in a methadone clinic. Stiller and Stahl have co-written a film adaptation of Bud Schulberg's What Makes Sammy Run, which has not yet been produced. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. In celebration of the 75th anniversary of Hank Williams' birth, a new CD box set has been released. Coming up, we hear selections from it and talk with Williams biographer Colin Escott. Also, film critic John Powers reviews One True Thing.
Don't you think maybe we could find us a brand new recipe? I got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill, and I know a spot right over the hill. There's soda pop and the dancing spree, so if you wanna have fun, come along with me. cooking something up with me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday was the 75th anniversary of the birth of Hank Williams, one of the originators of country music. In celebration, a new 10-CD box set has been released. It was co-produced by Colin Escott, who also wrote a biography of Williams. Escott says Williams made the single most important body of recordings in country music. He set the standard by which success is measured on every level, including self-destruction. Williams died at the age of 29. In his short 6-year recording career, he made such classics as Your Cheatin' Heart, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, Honky Tonkin', Cold Cold Heart, I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You, and Jambalaya. The song that made him a star was Lovesick Blues. The new box set includes a 1949 performance of the song when Williams made his debut on the Prince Albert Opry.
Welcome to the Love Sick Blues Boy, Hank Williams. Well, so Hank, we hope you're going to be around here with us for a long, long time, buddy.
Well, it looks like I'll be doing just that, Red, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, that's fine, just as we're all looking forward to that great Hank Williams hit. What else could it be but the Love Sick Blues?
I got a feeling called the blues. Oh, Lord, since my baby said goodbye, Lord, I don't know what I'll do. All I do is set and sigh. Oh, Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I thought I would cry. She'll do me, she'll do you. She's got the kind of loving, Lord, I looked to you when she called me sweet. Daddy, such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over. I've lost my heart, it seems. I've grown so used to you somehow. Lord, I'm nobody's sugar daddy now. And I'm lonesome. I got the lovesick blues.
I spoke with Colin Escott in 1994 after the publication of his biography of Hank Williams. I asked him to describe Williams' place in country music.
Before Hank, country music kind of existed in sort of discrete regional, as discrete regional units. You know, you had Western swing on the West Coast, and in Texas and Oklahoma you had cowboy music, you had East Coast Philadelphia country music, and you had hillbilly music. And I think what Hank did more than anything was to unify country music to the point where it became an identifiable commodity for the first time. You know, after Hank, there was just country music, and that was it.
Tell us a little bit about the family he grew up in and the home he grew up in.
Well, it seems like everyone figures they come from a dysfunctional family these days, but I don't know what Hank really did. You know, his father left home when he was about 6 and went into a Veterans Administration hospital in Louisiana, and Hank didn't see him but maybe once or twice for the next 10 or 12 years. And his mother was a fearsomely independent woman. She started up boarding house businesses, first in little towns like Greenville and Georgiana, and then in Montgomery. And Hank grew up there, but, you know, because his mom was running these boarding houses, she really didn't have a lot of time for little Hank. And, you know, Hank really grew up by himself, and you can sense a lot of that in the way he sings, you know, that kind of lonesomeness that everyone points out at the core of Hank Williams.
I want to play the very first record that he recorded. This was made in 1942, 6 years before he actually recorded commercially. The recording is I'm Not Coming Home Anymore. Tell us a little bit about the song and the circumstances under which he recorded this.
Well, it was cut at a radio store in Montgomery, and Hank was live every day on WSFA then, which was just about the only radio station of any size in Montgomery. And he had a little 15-minute show. And he was a big noise around Montgomery, and a guy that ran the radio shop there recorded him off the air. And that's really what you're hearing. It's just Hank. And if you listen closely, you can hear an electric guitar and a bass. But really, it's just Hank and his guitar. But the amazing thing is that 6 years before Hank became famous, his style was really pretty much in place.
Let's listen. In 1946, Hank Williams went to Nashville. Now Nashville's the Tin Pan Alley of country music. What was it like in the mid-40s when he went there?
Well, that's one of the things I really wanted to try and bring out in the book, that Nashville hadn't always been Nashville. You know, today you think of country music, you think of Nashville, like you think of Mutual and Omaha. But back then you had all kinds of regional centers for country music. You had the West Coast, Los Angeles, you had Chicago, you had Cincinnati, you had Philadelphia. And you had Memphis, you had Dallas, and Nashville was just one of many, and it hadn't yet established its preeminence. So when Hank went to Nashville, he wasn't going to the hub of country music as he would be today.
So what was he going to? How many music publishers were there? Were a lot of people recording there?
There were maybe a couple of music publishers in town, certainly no more than that, and there was one little bitty recording studio that was operated as a kind of moonlighting operation by some engineers at the Grand Ole Opry station, WSM. And really beyond that, there wasn't much. Such industry as there was kind of centered around the Opry. And in a way, it's a measure of Hank's achievement that the country music industry focused itself upon Nashville in the years ahead. It was partly due to the preeminence of the Opry, but the Opry's preeminence was partly or perhaps even mostly due to Hank.
So when he got to Nashville, he signed a writer's contract. What did that mean for him?
Well, it was the first step on the ladder. You know, everyone's got to take that first step, and this was Hank's. He had been invited to Nashville because Columbia Records had just signed a very traditional act called Molly O'Day and her Cumberland Mountain Folks, and Fred Rose, the music publisher, who was the one big music publisher in Nashville, had been assigned to find songs for Molly O'Day. And no one in his little operation was churning out anything that he thought Molly could use. And Molly told him about this guy down in Montgomery who was churning out just the kind of songs that she needed. And in that way, Hank came to Nashville.
I want to play one of Hank Williams' first commercially released recordings. And this is Move It On Over. Do you think that, in a way, this is one of his most important up-tempo recordings?
Well, it is, because what you hear there is the clear debt to black music. You know, that there really hadn't been a whole lot of black music influence in hillbilly music up to that point. And in Move It On Over, you can hear the debt that Hank owed to the black rural string bands that he'd grown up listening to, you know, down in southern Alabama.
This is Move It On Over, Hank Williams.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in, so move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed.
changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more, so get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, cause the fat dog's moving in.
You say that this recording, Move It On Over, shows the influence of black music on Hank Williams. He actually learned to play guitar from a black street musician.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wish to God I could have been there so that I'd know exactly what it was that Hank got off this guy. I mean, his name was T-Tot, or his nickname was T-Tot, because he drank out of a flask that had a mixture of tea and alcohol in it. And Hank used to follow him around almost obsessively. And he'd pay T-Tot, you know, whatever little money he could scrounge up to teach him what? I don't know, teach him chords maybe, certainly teach him in broader strokes, like the importance of getting a good rhythm going and how to project to an audience and things like that.
You know, I think a lot of us, because the South was segregated, a lot of us are surprised when we hear about a white musician who learned from a black musician or by a white musician who was so influenced by black music.
Yeah, I mean, everyone tends to think that that all started with Elvis Presley, but of course it didn't. And even before Hank, you had yodeling Jimmy Rogers down in Meridian, Mississippi, who grew up listening to the blues musicians down there. And when he started singing, it was a kind of curious mixture of you know, 1920s blues and sentimental Victorian pop songs. And you know, Rogers is called the father of country music, and you know, half of what he sang really was blues, but it was rarer, much rarer in hillbilly music, which really was rooted in Anglo-Celtic forms. And Hank was the first person to introduce elements of black music into hillbilly music.
My guest is Colin Escott, the author of a biography of Hank Williams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1994 interview with Colin Escott. He co-produced a new 10-CD box set of Hank Williams recordings. I want to move on to I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. This was actually the B-side of My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. What were they thinking when they released that as the B-side?
Well, one thing you got to appreciate is that a lot of Hank's records, all of Hank's records, were aimed at jukeboxes. They weren't aimed at buyers, you know, like record buyers the way they are today. The primary customer for records back then was jukebox operators. And you know, when people went to punch up a record on a jukebox, they didn't want to hear a slow, mournful song. They wanted something with a bit of zip in it. And you know, My Bucket's Got a Hole in It was just the ticket. And I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, for all its poeticism and everything, just didn't play as well on jukeboxes.
So how did I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry become the real... I assume that was the side that finally sold.
No, it wasn't. My Bucket's Got a Hole in It was the side that sold. That was the one that got up to number one and number two on the charts. I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry was just kind of languished as a B-side, and it wasn't until after Hank died and people started looking back at you know, started investigating his catalog in a little more detail, that they found songs like I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry and You Win Again, which was another B-side.
Well, let's hear I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long when time goes crawling by. The moon just went behind the clouds to hide
hide its face and cry.
Colin Escott is my guest. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. You say by 1951, Williams' career was controlling him. What were the problems he was having?
Well, most people wouldn't regard them as problems. You know, he was getting invitations from television networks to go on nationwide television. He was getting approaches from MGM's. You know, he recorded for MGM Records, and he was getting approaches from the movie division to make movies. He was being asked to headline country music shows in Boston, in Las Vegas, and just all over. Yeah, but Hank had a much keener sense of his limitations than anyone else did. And he was a guy who really didn't have a whole lot of education, and who 3 or 4 years earlier had been playing little schoolhouse dates and honky tonks and beer joints down in Louisiana and Alabama and East Texas for peanuts, really. And he found it very, very hard to cope with this new audience and the incredible career pressures of having to be at a certain place at a certain time. But when he started out, he'd play a beer joint, and if he showed. If he didn't, he'd do a make good if he felt like it. And if he didn't feel like it, he'd just blow it off. It all began to weigh heavily upon him.
Williams was a heavy drinker as far back as when he was a teenager. By the early 50s, how was alcohol affecting his reputation as a performer and a person?
Well, Hank's first response to stress was always to go reach for the bottle, and he did that more and more, partly because of the career pressures and partly because he suffered from a spinal condition called spina bifida, which must have been incredibly painful for him, riding those hundreds of thousands of miles in the car. And he drank basically to escape the career pressures and escape the pain that he had almost constantly from about 1950-51 onwards in his back. And the alcohol began to make him very unreliable. By the end of 51, the drinking was really starting to get out of control.
He was taking pain medication then too.
That's right. Yeah, he was mixing it with heavy duty barbiturates, and this was starting to affect his show rate. You know, the reliability of him turning up was sinking from maybe 85-90% to maybe 500, maybe 50%.
He was only 29 when he died. What killed him?
It was a combination of everything he was doing. It was a combination of morphine, which he was taking for his back, chloral hydrate, which he was taking for his back pain, and alcohol, together with a generally dissipated physical condition that came from the lifestyle he had led for the last 5 or 6 years, really. Everything weighed upon him, and by the time he died, he was really a man without another option. He was physically wrecked. The back pain was irremediable. The alcoholism was something that he couldn't escape from, no matter how hard he tried. And his death, which has so often been described as a dreadful accident, was just an accident that was waiting to happen.
Colin Escott, do you think that Hank Williams influenced country music not only in terms of his music, but also in terms of himself as the tragic figure? I mean, that sense of the tragic figure has become so important in the mythology of country music.
Yeah, everyone, when someone drives their truck into Nashville hoping to make it in the business, they've always got Hank Williams in the back of their mind and always thinking that they're going to avoid his terrible fate. But that live hard, love fast, die young thing is just rooted in, it's just part of country music mythology.
Colin Escott recorded in 1994, after the publication of his biography of Hank Williams. Williams would have been 75 yesterday. Escott has co-produced a new 10-CD box set of Williams' recordings. It includes this 1952 demo of Your Cheatin' Heart.
Your Cheatin' Heart. cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come. The whole I do, your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain, you'll toss around and call my name. You'll walk the floor the way I do. Your cheating heart
coming up, John Powers reviews One True Thing. This is Fresh Air. Anna Quinlan has written a few bestsellers since giving up her New York Times column. Now her novel, One True Thing, has been adapted into a film. It stars Meryl Streep, William Hurt, and Renee Zellweger. The film is directed by Carl Franklin. Our movie critic John Powers has a review.
Back in the 30s and 40s, Hollywood was run by cigar-chomping moguls who knew that their audience was made up of both men and women. While they produced countless crime movies and westerns, they also churned out scores of so-called women's pictures, sentimental stories of love and loss. Bette Davis seemed to die in a lot of them. Gone with the Wind was the greatest of them. Weepies, as they were sometimes known, were a large and honorable part of the movie business. These days, Hollywood is managed by overgrown boys who've lost their feel for the female audience. They don't grasp that Titanic is a gargantuan weepy, and so they crank out more action pictures than ever before, but treat the traditional women's film as something slightly pathetic, better suited to the Lifetime channel than the multiplex. Many critics and moviegoers feel pretty much the same. They're embarrassed by the naked emotionalism of women's films. People who will angrily defend the male sentimentality of Saving Private Ryan, where a character is killed after giving a speech about his mom, will lambaste Hope Floats for being corny and trite. I hope people will be more generous to One True Thing, a latter-day weepy that's incomparably better than boy flicks like Blade, Snake Eyes, Armageddon, or Lethal Weapon 4. Renee Zellweger stars as Ellen Golden, an ambitious young reporter for New York Magazine. Ellen idolizes her father, George, a literature prof played by William Hurt. But she's always felt a bit oppressed by her mother, Kate, that's Meryl Streep, a traditional mom whose life has always struck her as terribly small. But all this changes when Kate gets cancer, and Ellen, not altogether happily, returns home to their small college town to look after her. It's an awkward situation for them both, from the moment Ellen first gets back to the family house.
I'm home for a while. I took some time off from work.
Home where? Here? Well, what about your job and your little apartment?
Well, I'm gonna work from here. So, oh, don't worry about
it.
No. Tweety said that it's fine.
Oh, no, so. No. Not to play nursemaid to me.
Oh, no, that's not.
Oh, I don't need... Man, you'll hate me. I'll just make you some dinner.
No, I want to stay. At least until you feel better. I mean, it's the right thing.
For who? Whose idea was this?
Mine. Dad, and, well, it was both of ours.
He shouldn't have asked you to do this, honey, because he knows you. He knows this will never work.
No, now, I told Dad that I want to do this, and I'm going to, so that's final, okay?
One true thing is about something quite familiar. How children eventually learn to see their parents as human beings, not just parents. Ellen discovers that her adored father is actually a weak, unreliable, self-pitying man who sinks into his narcissism like a Northern Californian into his hot tub. He's so preeningly self-absorbed that you can understand why they cast William Hurt to play him. Ellen also comes to see that her mother isn't simply a cheerful, ultra-maternal creature insanely devoted to decorating Christmas trees. She's the glue that holds life together, both in the family and the community. In a sense, the story's portrait of Kate is a guilty post-feminist act of restitution to all the stay-at-home mothers whose daughters disdained them. But the movie is such an act of restitution that Kate is actually granted far less complexity than either her deeply flawed husband or her ambitious, ambivalent daughter, gamely played by the pouty Zellweger. In the end, Kate's presented less as a woman than a paragon, the one true thing of the title. Although the movie is often far too pat, it's a good, decent, and touching piece of work. This is partly because Streep gives a performance that grows harrowingly real as Kate nears death. But the real credit belongs to director Carl Franklin, best known for One False Move and Devil in a Blue Dress, who keeps finding emotional truth in a story that tends toward glibness, like the obligatory scene where Ellen, the career woman, makes a shambles of cooking lunch. Franklin never looks down on any of his characters, even unlikable ones like Ellen's shifty boyfriend, and he has too much reverence for life to be dishonest about death. His thrillers never let us enjoy it when the villain is killed. He makes us feel what it means for even a bad man to die. And he doesn't milk Kate's passing here, doesn't squeeze our tear ducts with Spielbergian music. He treats such familial loss with tender restraint, letting us decide how we want to respond. That's why One True Thing does what the best women's movies have always done. It shows the power of life's most intimate bonds and lets you cry without feeling ashamed.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Shurrock and Kathy Wolf and directed by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross. Let's close with a recording by singer Johnny Adams, who died of cancer earlier this week.
I cover the waterfront. I'm watching the sea. Well, the one I love be coming back to me. I cover the waterfront. In search of my love, and I'm covered by a starless sky above. Here am I, patiently waiting, hoping and longing.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape by the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences, in bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.